This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Today, we're spending the hour with Ray Boomhauer, senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press and the author of a new biography titled Richard Tregaskis, Reporting Under Fire from Guadalcanal to Vietnam. Welcome to the program, Ray.
Great to be with you this afternoon.
Later in the show, we're going to get into Richard's story, but I wanted to start by talking about your new book about him. How long have you known about Richard Tregaskis? And I guess, how did you first hear about him?
Well, I have always been interested in the Pacific theory of operations in World War II. And this was inspired in part by this Time Life series of books that I read while I was in high school. Our high school library was well stocked with them. And they looked at individual operations as well as both the European and Pacific theaters. But the Pacific attracted me because just of the vast distances involved in getting into the action. And so I was inspired to read first-person accounts of the war in the Pacific, and I was naturally attracted to Guadalcanal Diary, which is Richard Tregaskis' best-selling book about his experiences during the first 7 weeks of combat with the U.S. Marines on Guadalcanal, this small island in the Solomons during World War II, and its pitched battle that the Marines had with the Japanese trying to throw them off the island. So that's really where I first came across his name. Of course, that book was later made into a Hollywood movie, Guadalcanal Diary.
Well, what struck out or stuck out to you about Richard early on when you were reading about him that made you want to do more work to learn about him?
I was just fascinated by the wide scope of his experiences during the war. He was there very early on in the desperate days in the Pacific following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that thrust the United States into war. He worked for the International News Service, which is a news agency like Associated Press, United Press at the time. And he was sent to Hawaii to report on fleet operations. And he was managed to be in on some of the key points in the war in the Pacific. He watched from a nearby ship as the Doolittle Raiders took off from the USS Hornet carrier to bomb Tokyo, an early, really big shot in the arm for the Americans early on in the war. Because up to that point, the war had gone very badly. The Japanese were running wild in the Pacific, winning victory after victory. And this was our first real shot at hitting back at them. From there, he transferred to the Hornet and was on it for its action in the great turning point in the war in the Pacific, the Battle of Midway, which was a great defeat for the Japanese Navy and really turned the tide in the Pacific. After that, he was on Guadalcanal for the first 7 weeks of the fighting there and returned to Hawaii to finish writing his best-selling book, Guadalcanal Diary. And if you just look at that period of time, you think, well, he did quite a bit, but he wasn't finished. He went back to Guadalcanal, flew on B-17 bombers on missions against Japanese installation in the Pacific, returned to the United States for rest, but then went into action in the European theater, which was unusual for a war correspondent. Usually, if you were a war reporter, you stayed in one theater of operation, either the Pacific or in Europe. But Tregaskis was there for the invasion of Sicily and also for the invasion of Italy. And then, although he had had some near misses, getting injured and almost killed while he was in the Pacific, in Italy, his a number finally came up, and he was severely wounded by a German shell. And Ernie Pyle, the great correspondent from Indiana, the great Hoosier newspaper reporter, even wrote a column after visiting Tregaskis at an evacuation hospital and said, you know, if I'd undergone all he had, I would have gone home and rested in my laurels forever. But Tregaskis did not do that. He recovered in the United States, returned to Europe after the D-Day breakout in June 1944, and was there for the sweep across Europe for the first battle to capture a major German city, Aachen, Germany. And after that, decided to go back home and started reporting for the Saturday Evening Post for a series called The Road to Tokyo. And the editors at the Post at the time asked him, well, do you really want to go? And he said, I don't want to go, but I think I have to go. So he returned to the Pacific, flying on B-29 bomber missions over Japan, and was there when the atomic bomb was dropped, ending the war. Was in on the early occupation of Japan with MacArthur's military government, and finally returned home after that. His war was over, but it was quite a journey for him.
It sounds like he had the front seat to a lot of historical events.
He did. He was there early on, always wanted to see for himself what the men were doing on the front lines in combat. Another of my subjects, a war correspondent, Robert Sherrod, who followed the Marines in the Central Pacific during World War II, said, a lot of the first-rate war correspondents did not want to be known as what he called communique commandos. And these were reporters who stayed behind the lines and got canned handouts from people back at the headquarters area. And Tregaskis, Sherrod, and Pyle, and reporters like them did not want to do that. They wanted to be at the front, seeing for themselves what was going on, so they could let the people back on the home front know what was happening to their loved ones overseas.
It's definitely a unique career for someone to have as a war reporter. What do you find interesting about war reporters?
I think the fact that they don't have to be there. If you're drafted, of course, if you're in the military, you're have a responsibility to go. But the civilian journalist went into action and faced very dangerous odds, and they could have stayed at home safe and sound, but decided not to. In fact, casualty rates for reporters were just as bad as they were for the armed forces during World War II. For reporters, 2.2% of them in action were killed, 6.8% were wounded, and the rates for the armed forces were 2.5% killed and 4.5% wounded. And although AP correspondent Hal Boyle said that if you wanted to be a war correspondent, all you needed was a strong stomach, a weak mind, and plenty of endurance, I think he was joking about that. I just admire them for having the courage to go to the front lines, endure the rigors of combat as the infantry and the Marines did, the seamen on the ships, air crews in planes, and try to report as best they could, given the censorship of the time, what was going on during the war.
Yeah, that's got to be difficult. I'm just wondering how things have changed from World War II to our current time when reporters go out to cover things. Is it still sort of censored, or are they able to get around things? But yeah.
Well, of course, communication is quite different between now and World War II. You have instantaneous communication, so I think censorship is perhaps even more strict than it was during World War II. You don't have the vast differences and the problems with getting your dispatches back to your home office in the United States. It was a very torturous process, and often, sometimes, dispatches were lost at sea. Sherrod, at one point, tried to write some articles and airdrop them to another ship to take to transmit back to his home office at Time Life magazine, but they were lost and never arrived, so you had that difficulty. You never knew while you were reporting from the front lines if your dispatches were even appearing in newspapers or in magazines back in the United States. Mm-hmm. Tregaskis said at one point, wrote in a letter to his sister saying that, and it was kind of like you never knew the impact of what you're writing, if you're having any impact at all. It was just kind of like writing letters back home. You never knew if they might arrive or not.
That's so fascinating. And just to clarify, when you said AirDrop, that's not something that you do with your phone.
No, that's something that plane tried to drop a package onto another ship in very difficult seas at the time, I believe.
Wow, that's just all, like, it's so interesting to think how much things have changed in terms of just the way things are delivered. When it comes to this biography, how were you able to research it? Were there a lot of firsthand sources you were able to talk to, or did you have to go through newspaper articles?
Well, thankfully, a lot of Tregaskis's dispatches for the International News Service are available through online sources now. You don't have to go to the library and crank through the old microphone film reels and get a headache as you're spinning past various articles trying to get to the one you want. Services like newspapers.com are a great boon for researchers doing work in American newspapers. Also, he left behind a great amount of material, letters and diary entries, dispatches he wrote at two repositories, one at the Gottlieb Archival Research Center at Boston University, and the second at the American Heritage Center in at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. So I was able to visit both of the archives and go through all the material there. And I discovered, and I didn't know this was available at the time, when I went to the American Heritage Center in his papers there, he had written an unfinished memoir of his time in World War II and had finished it up to the time when he's landing with the Marines on Guadalcanal. So that was a great help, because I didn't have a lot of material about his early days in combat when he was first sent overseas by the International News Service. And, of course, there are various letters he wrote back home, especially to his sister Madeline and his parents while he was overseas.
We'll continue this conversation after a quick break. I want to know more about any specific texts or person that became extremely helpful for your research. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking to Indiana biographer Ray Boomhauer about his new book titled Richard Tregaskis, Reporting Under Fire from Guadalcanal to Vietnam. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobel. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today with Ray Boomhauer, senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press and author of the new biography, Richard Tregaskis, Reporting Under Fire from Guadalcanal to Vietnam. We were talking briefly before the break just about putting together this biography. And I'm curious to know, what was the most valuable source you ended up finding for this when you put it together? Was there a specific person or a text that became extremely helpful for you?
The memoir was particularly helpful that I talked about earlier. Also, the papers at the American Heritage Center in Laramie, there were these first drafts of his dispatches when he was reporting for the Road to Tokyo series that he produced for the Saturday Evening Post magazine. And these are extensive details about the time he spent with the B-29 bomber crew on missions over Tokyo. They flew off from the United States on this long mission to their base on Guam. And he has detailed notes about his dealings with the crew that of that bomber. It goes on to include his stories that were never published. He had a multi-part series about his time with the B-29 crew. But from there, he went on a carrier, the USS Ticonderoga, and flew on combat missions against a Japanese naval base on an Avenger bomber off that aircraft carrier, and had some great interactions with its pilot and the crewmen on the carrier. And once again, he was lucky. He successfully survived that bombing mission. And he was resting up, and the next day the pilot he flew with and his crew member went on another mission, and the plane something went wrong with the plane, and it spun in and crashed, killing the pilot he had become friendly with, as well as the crewmen. But all that great experience, a great detail, never saw the light of day because it came at the end of the war in the Pacific. And just the news, the shocking news of the atomic bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki overshadowed that. And so some of his best work, I think, never saw the light of day, and has been whiling away all this time in boxes at the American Heritage Center. Unfortunately, a lot of his contemporaries, people he worked with during the war, are no longer around. But his third wife, Moana Trigaskis, was still alive when I was doing my research, and she was very helpful. She lives in Hawaii now, and she's a noted reporter in her own right, and worked with him during his trips to Vietnam later on after World War II. And she was very helpful in answering email questions for me about her time with him and their life together in Hawaii. So she was a great resource I could draw upon for the book, and was very good about responding to any questions I had.
As a biographer, is it ever difficult, let's say, when you come across things that may be conflicting accounts or information? How do you handle that type of situation?
You have to be upfront, and I did run across that in the case of Trigaskis. He's a very tall man. You see photos of him in the book. He towers over other people in the photographs. But there was always this discrepancy, you know, just how tall was he? Different published reports and different articles about him all give varying heights, from 6'6", 6'7". Some even say he was tall as 6'9". So, you know, what do you get for his height? You know, all these different things. But I did have to depend upon his official accreditation from the War Department that lists him at 6'5". And if you see a photograph of him in the book with General Mark Clark in Italy, General Clark was considered tall. He's, I think it was 6'3". But if you look at the photograph, Trigaskis is a couple inches taller than he was. So I'm comfortable with 6'5". But I explain all that in a footnote in the book. But that's some of the difficulties that a biographer comes across. And also, you sometimes never know the full story. You're left wondering what happened. He was very close to his sister, Madeline, who eventually committed suicide during the war when he was overseas. And I got some newspaper accounts of, you know, of people finding her in her car after she killed herself. But I never really got any letters from him to his family or from his family to him talking about their grief about her death. And that's something I wish I did have.
I do want to talk about Richard's life and career, which you detail in your biography here. But let's start with where did Richard grow up?
He's from Elizabeth, New Jersey. His father worked for the Singer Sewing Company, had a job in the communications department there. Grew up, was always tall. Young Dick was. Loved swimming. Also love reading accounts about adventures from World War I. Had an early interest in journalism from the first. He went to a couple of prep schools near his hometown. And his father, because of the Great Depression, really couldn't afford it. So he had to win scholarships. He was a very studious boy and helped support his education by writing accounts of sports activities at the school, you know, ceremonies at the school for local newspapers. And he even invented pseudonyms for himself so he could get more and more articles in papers and get more and more money for his education. He continued to do that when he attended Harvard University. He'd won scholarships for that. But also wrote for local Boston area newspapers articles about what was going on at Harvard to help support himself through that. working at a variety of odd jobs as well. And there's one interesting detail about his time at Harvard. As I said, he loves swimming, and he won a place as probably the last backstroker on the Harvard swim team. And the guy he beat out for that spot was a young John Kennedy, the future president of the United States, and of course, a hero from World War II for his time with PT 109.
Wow, it's like a small world, I guess you could say.
It is. And later on, after the war, and when Kennedy was president, Tregaskis wrote a book aimed at kids about Kennedy's experiences during the war and that PT-109 disaster where his ship was cut into, his patrol torpedo boat was cut into by a Japanese destroyer, and he managed to save a lot of his crew, and they were eventually found and rescued. So two young men who were fighting one another for a space on the swim team eventually came back together once again.
When we talk about Richard getting involved in journalism, would you say that it was by chance because he was trying to support himself so he got these odd jobs, or did that seem like the path he really wanted to go down?
I think it's a path that he wanted to go down. It's something that he continued after the war as a freelance writer, although he always later advised those who wanted to pursue a writing career that they should get some other job and write on the side. He was one of those rare people after the war who made a living from what emerged from his typewriter. He traveled extensively all around the world, writing for such publications as Collier's, Sports Illustrated, Argosy, True Magazine, and also Reader's Digest. He had a brief career as a screenwriter in Hollywood, writing for the movies and television. But that never really panned out for him. And he always searched for interesting and topical subjects to support his freelance writing career. He settled in Hawaii and had a large book collection that he used for reference purposes. He said that, books were tools for him, and used that about 60% of the books on his bookshelves were reference works. And one time when he was living in California, his personal collection reached more than 8,000 volumes. He said, it took immense courage to stick at a freelance career for any length of time because there were always too many periods of famine and debt. And he said that given a minimum level of competence, the main job of a writer is to buy time so that he or she can devote himself to projects that they consider important. He spent a lot of time selling his ideas for projects, books, and scripts, and he found that he spent 75 to 80% of his time selling himself to editors or promoting his work to the public, which is, a part of a writer's job these days as well. He once lamented that, one should have just more time to write, just sit down and write, and always looking for that time. He always felt the lure of the adventure and romance of combat and returned to it for the Vietnam War in the early 1960s during the early days of the American involvement there. Went overseas and produced another best-selling book using that same diary format that worked so well for him during World War II, where he produced both a Guadalcanal diary and an invasion diary. And this time came up with a book called Vietnam Diary. And I should mention, there's one aspect that looms over his career as a war reporter, the fact that he was doing all this while he was dealing with a very difficult medical condition, diabetes, which was diagnosed right after he had gotten his job with the International News Service in the early 1940s. And the condition that when he was sent overseas, he tried to keep secret from his employers and other journalists of the time. And so he's doing all this while having to worry about a debilitating condition that eventually killed his father.
Yeah, that's got to be tough knowing that that his father died of that, and then he has the same thing and dealing with that in the middle of a war. How did he become a war reporter? Was that something people volunteered for back then? Did they work for a company? Were they forced and drafted into it?
They weren't forced or drafted into it. A lot of reporters, you know, wanted to become war correspondents. It's a chance to make a name for themselves. And in Tregaskis's case, unfortunately for him, he really wanted to volunteer when the war broke out after the December 7th, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor. But his eyesight was too poor. Plus, he was too tall at 6'5". And being turned down for service really affected him mentally. He was quite upset about this. Thought at one point about killing himself, but decided instead that he wanted to go overseas and become a war correspondent. And luckily enough, his editor, Barry Ferris, at the New York office of the International News Service, offered him the opportunity. He had two choices. He could go either to London or Australia, and he picked Australia. But on the way there, they decided to send him to Hawaii and cover fleet operations from Honolulu instead of going all the way to Australia. And he got his chance to do something for the war effort, and he did it well.
What was being a war reporter back then more seen as a patriotic duty for American war reporters, or it was a career?
It was both, I think. Reporters at that time, of course, were all on the side of the Americans. You know, we're fighting fascism in Germany and Japan. And so it was easy for correspondents to fall in line with dictates from the military. They had to follow certain guidelines. They were given great treatment by the armed forces. If you were a war correspondent, a civilian war correspondent during World War II, you were given kind of an honorary rank of captain. So you have opportunity to go to the PX, buy the materials you needed. You could go to officers' clubs and talk to officers involved in the fighting. The military fed and transported you into action. But you had to abide by the censorship as well. You getting all this great treatment, but you also had to have your stories looked at by PROs, public relations officers, and censors. And it was difficult at times because each service had their own way of looking at censorship. The U.S. Navy was seen as some of the tightest when it came to censorship. Early on in the war in the Pacific, and you can kind of see why, because things were going very badly for the American forces in the war against Japan at that time. People even joke that if Admiral Ernest King, who was chief of naval operations in Washington, had his way, there'd only be two communiques issued all during the war, one that was over, and the second, we'd won it. So Tregaskis and other correspondents had to deal with this. But there's a lot of self-censorship going on as well. John Steinbeck, the noted novelist, was a war correspondent himself during World War II. And he said that, they all knew what was expected of them. And there was a lot of self-censorship. And there was a huge and gassy thing, he said, called the war effort. And anything that interfered with or ran counter to the war effort was automatically bad. So they, correspondents edited themselves much more than they were edited. But the censors had a tough job as well, because they weren't going to get a lot of credit from their superiors for letting through a lot of detail about the war. No, they were more worried about letting information out that might be harmful. So they were meticulous when it came to censoring any kind of detail that they thought might give aid and comfort to the enemy. And Tregaskis realized this when he had was back in Honolulu producing his manuscript about Guadalcanal Diary. His notebooks and material from his time in the Pacific was taken by the Navy and locked up in a safe. So he had to go to Naval headquarters every day, use those notes and documents to write his manuscript. And then it was locked up again for the evening. And he complained one time that the censor who was going through his manuscript edited out a detail that he had noted that the Japanese encampments he came across had a kind of Swedish smell, an odor to them. And the censor had deleted this from his manuscript. And he wondered why. Did he think that perhaps the Japanese would start wearing a specific brand of deodorant? He didn't know why that particular detail was excised from his work.
That's interesting. Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking to Indiana biographer Ray Boomhauer about his new book called Richard Tregaskis, Reporting Under Fire from Guadalcanal to Vietnam. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam So. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're spending the hour today with Ray Boomhauer, senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press and author of the new biography, Richard Tregaskis, Reporting Under Fire from Guadalcanal to Vietnam. Ray, before the break, we started talking about the experiences as a war correspondent and sort of the censorships and the things that went on. Do you think that Richard was censored as much as all other reporters, or was he more censored, or was there any indication of how that worked?
Alike, it all depended upon your location, where you were, what service you were dealing with, and also what was going on the battlefront. Tregaskis pointed this out. He was resting at home following his experiences after the street fighting in Aachen, Germany. And he wrote an article about how to read the war news, giving tips to those on the home front who are wondering, you know, just what's going on overseas and how do I tell what's accurate and what isn't. And he noted that, you know, when things were going badly for American forces during the war, that's when really censorship came heavily upon reporters' dispatches. So you had to look for that. You had to look for datelines. Where was a particular article coming from? For example, overseas, during the Battle of the Bulge, if you were seeing reports from Dateline with a Paris, that meant that the reporter was probably writing from the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force. And that was miles behind the line. And a reporter doing an article on the fighting was probably getting the information not firsthand, but from officers who were given briefings daily about what was going on. And so you had to kind of take those with a grain of salt. But if a reporter's dispatches said, like, with the First Army or with Patton's Third Army, they might have a better idea of the scope of the fighting and just how close of a thing it was in the battle against the Germans. And he thought there was a sad thing about the state of public information in that some editors at newspapers and other publications thought that the public would only buy good news, that they couldn't take or be interested in bad news or of reverses in combat. And he'd heard many times from editors at different publications saying, in effect, that the public isn't interested in bad news, you can't sell it. And he thought that anyone who said that was probably laboring under delusion that the American public had a child mind, and furthermore, the mind of a spoiled child, which he saw as probably as false and low grade a conclusion as the presumption that Americans couldn't and would not learn how to read the war news intelligently. And one of the aspects of his work and the work of particularly because he was working early on in the war for the International News Service is that his dispatches about the fighting, you know, were often the only news that readers and small newspapers around the country could rely upon for what was going on in the war. The scope of his the coverage that he received was vast. His dispatches were in big and small newspapers from California, Texas, North, South Dakota, Maine, Florida, all over the country. So he was always well aware of the fact that I have to be in as accurate as I can in these dispatches that are I'm sending back home.
Well, Richard Tregaskis not only reported about World War II, he reported about other wars after that. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Cold War and Vietnam? And, you know, they were different wars in many ways to World War II. Did Richard seem to have a different experience reporting on those?
He came into conflict, I think, with some of the younger reporters that were sent to South Vietnam, to Saigon, to report on the American involvement there. People like David Halberstam, Neil Sheehan, Malcolm Brown, who questioned the official optimistic view of events from administration officials there. And I think he had trouble because of his own experiences in combat during World War II. And his belief, unflinchingly until the end of his life, in the need for the United States to respond forcefully to communist aggression, especially in Vietnam, and also his continued admiration for the skill and bravery of American troops in the field. And the new generation reporters seemed to be take this product, you know, they took at face value what the government told them. And Tregaskis believed that criticizing the war belittled the courage of the troops, while Halberstam and those other young reporters saw that pointing out the errors and how the war was going was actually helping the troops in the field. And Tregaskis also believed that the casualties and defeats on the battlefield early on in the war were a small cost to pay to help stem the tide of communism from sweeping over South Vietnam and throughout Southeast Asia. And it was a different battle. You know, in World War II, you knew where the front lines were, but in South Vietnam, the front seemed to be everywhere, as Tregaskis learned as he made frequent trips to South Vietnam to report on what was going on with American forces there, particularly as we sent more and more troops to Vietnam.
If you're tuning in and have a question or comment, you can reach out to us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Ray Boomhauer, senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press and author of the new biography, Richard Tregaskis, Reporting Under Fire from Guadalcanal to Vietnam. Ray, I'm curious about how Vietnam, you know, because it became so famous for being this televised war, disturbing footage on the news had an impact on public perception and support for the war. Did that impact Richard Tregaskis at all in his reporting or his thoughts on just how the information was being disseminated?
I think he tried as best he could to disseminate as accurate as information as he had during his time in World War II. And since the war ended, he'd been really concerned about the rise of communism and our failure he saw in countering its growth through what he wanted, which was a vigorous propaganda effort. That's an issue he tried but failed to gain the attention of editors throughout the country. He even sent essays to a variety of news services saying they could publish them without charge. But he said that his work was too controversial to be used. He saw that the Chinese Civil War, with the victory of Mao Zedong's revolutionary forces against Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government, had been the Pearl Harbor of what he called World War III. and this cycle of small civil wars that have broken out in a variety of countries, including South Vietnam, he thought, had all been laid out by Lenin in the 1920s with the Soviet Union spreading its political creed throughout the world. And he wanted America to take more steps to counter this propaganda. He said that, you know, we have a cabinet officer to handle our mail deliveries, but not one in charge of our international public relations. And he saw this as something that he tried to bring out in his dispatches from South Vietnam. And that sometimes brought him into conflict with these young reporters. And it was different in Vietnam, too, because the war could be brought home in a more immediate fashion than it could have in World War II. Photographs could be transmitted much more quickly. News broadcasts could be piped into people's homes every evening, showing scenes of war that people could not imagine during World War II. And a single photo could have a lasting effect on public perception about the war. I'm working now on a book about Malcolm Brown, who was the AP bureau chief in Saigon. And he managed to capture in 1963, during a Buddhist protest there, a Buddhist monk who set himself on fire in protest against the Diem government. And that just that one image, you know, could be seen in newspapers across the country in just a day. And it could have an impact on the American government's position in the war. Henry Cabot Lodge, who was going to be the new ambassador, remember going to John Kennedy's office, and he had newspapers on his desk with Malcolm Brown's photo featured in it. He said, you know, we've got to do something about that government in South Vietnam. So one photo could have an effect on American foreign policy.
Well, why didn't Richard make it out of his career alive? What happened to him?
He died at age 56. He was known for daily swims in Hawaii, and he was out swimming one day and had a heart attack and died. And just after, you know, he survived. It's kind of ironic that he survived all this combat, and here he's, you know, participating in one of his favorite hobbies, swimming, and that's when he dies.
What legacy do you think he has?
His legacy is one, I think, of courage, of accuracy, of speaking out on behalf of the fighting men during World War II and subsequent wars that America was involved with up to Vietnam. Always someone who had a knack for finding the news, a knack for attaching himself to figures that could be sure that they'd be involved in heavy fighting, and someone who was very concerned about the American fighting men on the front lines and what was happening to them, and getting that information back to the public at home so they knew of the sacrifices that these men were making for the country.
Is Richard Tragaskis remembered as much as he should be?
I don't think so, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book. Of course, as a former newspaper reporter myself, that's where I started out my career as reporters. You know, their stories are always something that attracts me, and I wanted to tell his story for a new generation, showing what he did during the war and the sacrifices he made. And it was a sacrifice he always felt happy at doing, because he felt he owed it to the country and to his readers.
I mean, I'll be honest, as a journalist myself, I'd never heard of him until this book that you're putting out. But maybe because also I don't know much about war correspondence from back in the day. Were there a lot of war reporters like him? Is that why he's kind of overlooked? Because there might have been some that really took to the public eye?
I think if you're looking at World War II, if you're talking about war correspondence, The one name that springs to mind is our own Hoosier reporter, Ernie Pyle. His was a name that features prominently in any book about World War II, and he was just so beloved by the average GI in the war that it's hard to get other names to the fore. But there were a variety of reporters, men and women, who should be better known, like Tregaskis, Robert Sherrod, Hal Boyle, Don Whitehead, Marguerite Higgins, Martha Gellhorn, Ruth Cohen, and of course the women reporters during the war faced a lot more obstacles than their male comrades, particularly from officers at the front lines who always were worried about having a woman in danger in combat, and also some of their colleagues who didn't want to have women outshining them when it came to reporting about the war. So a lot of these names should be better known than they are today. And I hope with my book that will change.
Do you hear often from folks like me that say they'd never heard of Tregaskis until you did this book?
Usually they've heard of Guadalcanal Diary. They might not connect the name to the book or the movie. But once I say Guadalcanal Diary, Richard, and I say it was by him, they recognize that name. It's kind of like what happened to Lew Wallace here in the Hoosier State. If you say Ben-Hur, people will know that because his book was made into the famous movie with Charlton Heston. But if you ask them, it was based on a book written by a Hoosier, they're not sure about that, but until you let them know that. So with all my books, I'm trying to present to readers names that I think should be more notable and remembered today. And I hope that happens with this biography of Tregaskis.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, is there anything while working on this that stuck out to you that I guess you'll remember forever?
I think the fact that he didn't have to go back to the war. He had done enough after being wounded in Italy. He lost the power of speech because of the shell fragments that entered his brain. He lost the use of his right hand, and the prognosis was not good, but he willed himself. He recited poetry. He exercised his hand. And managed to, get back to where he was before. And after all that, I would have just stayed home and safe and rested on my laurels, as Pyle said. But he felt he had more to say and more to write about the war. And he went back. He continued to go back. And that's something I'll always admire about him.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon to talk about your book. Ray Boomhauer is senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press and author of a new biography titled Richard Tregaskis, Reporting Under Fire from Guadalcanal to Vietnam. Ray, where can folks get your book?
The usual places, as well as here at the Indiana Historical Society's Bazille History Market. If you stop by here and tell them you'd like an autograph, I'll be happy to come down and do that for you.
Thank you so much. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. And you can always leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.